to the Nervata podcast for complex health.
We feature guests who dive deeply into the nuances of medicine with the goal of inspiring you to persistently heal in the face of inevitable challenge across the lifespan. This is about ancient and cutting edge understanding of disease processes and treatments just as much as it is about food, lifestyle, nature, culture, and politics. I'm Jillian Ehrlich, family nurse practitioner certified in Ayurveda and functional medicine at our clinic, Nervata Health in Seattle, Washington. And I have a really exciting and very practical guest for you here today. Dr. Todd Levine has over 20 years of experience as a clinical neurologist with a subspecialty in disorders of the peripheral nervous system. He received his medical degree from Duke University and did his residency and fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis. He has served as chairman of the neuromuscular division of the American Academy of Neurology. And in 2010, he founded his first medical diagnostics company called Corinthian Reference Lab, CRL, and has processed over 50,000 skin biopsies, which is like so much skin, so many skin biopsies. He's received these specimens from over 4,000 different neurologists across the U.S. and Canada. Dr. Levine is one of the three founders of CND Life Sciences and serves as its chief medical officer, playing a key role in the delivery of diagnostic services and ongoing technology development. Dr. Levine also currently serves as the director of neuroscience research at the Honor Health Research Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Levine, welcome. We're so happy to have you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's dive in. You know, our topic today is kind of about skin biopsies and what that is and what they do, but let's back up and do a little bit more kind of an umbrella look. So when we talk about disorders of the peripheral nervous system or neuromuscular medicine, can you kind of give us some initial definitions about what that means and what diseases those specialties are associated with?
Yeah, of course. So one of the traditional ways of thinking about the nervous system is to break it into two parts. We call it the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system is the brain and the spinal cord. And then the peripheral nerves are the nerves as they leave the spinal cord and go out to the body, and then the nerves from the body that come back to the spinal cord. The other part of the peripheral nervous system is actually the muscle. So when we want to move, we have signals that come out from the spinal cord, travel along a nerve. That nerve then tells the muscle to move. So the particular branch of neurology that I subspecialized in are diseases that affect the nerve and the muscle.
Okay. And can you name some of like how would we know those diseases?
So probably the most common is what we call neuropathy. So that's a condition where many different types of diseases can damage the nerves. The most common probably being diabetes that can cause peripheral neuropathy. And patients will experience anything from numbness to tingling to burning to stabbing sensations because those nerves are misfiring. They're sick in some way. And so they're not sending the appropriate signal, and the brain then perceives that as some kind of aberrant or incorrect message.
Okay, great.
There are other diseases that fall under the neuromuscular rubric as well. So Lou Gehrig's disease is a very severe form of nerve disease where the nerves start to die and we don't understand why. Muscular dystrophies where the muscles are sick and the muscles start to die. And then a number of autoimmune conditions that are more rare. Actually, now there are TV commercials because there are medications for some of these diseases. So you might see a commercial for a disease called myasthenia gravis or a disease called CIDP, which are all conditions where a person's own immune system starts to attack their nerves or muscle.
And so really, we can kind of break these down. Tell me if I'm thinking about this correctly, kind of in the sensory world. So patients might have sensory disruptions, or they might have motor disruptions where you kind of can't move muscles, muscles don't move, or you might have both. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in the peripheral nervous system, we break that really into three groups. So as you said, one is motor. Those are the nerves that let you move. The second are sensory, which are the nerves that let you feel. And then the third are what we call autonomic nerves. And the autonomic nerves control our automatic behaviors, things you can't think about changing. So for example, your heart rate, your blood pressure, your sweating, your digestion, your temperature regulation. You can't sit there and think, oh, I want to make my blood pressure go up or down. For the most part, people can't do that. You can't say, I want to sweat or I want to stop sweating. The body does that automatically. So those three divisions, motor, sensory, and autonomic, are the three divisions of the peripheral nervous system.
Okay. And do we see like
Like what's most, I mean, you did talk about diabetes, which I think is most one of the most common neuropathies that we see. Do you see any other kind of like clusters of those diseases, like in certain parts of the country or from certain triggers, like chemical triggers?
So there are many different causes for things that can damage the nerves. And actually, I sort of joke, unfortunately, that the most common cause for a neuropathy is what we call idiopathic. And the joke there is that we're too much of an idiot to figure out why that is. But basically, those are people that have neuropathy with no cause that we can identify. That's probably the most common. The second, as you said, would be diabetes. But we see it from nutritional deficiencies. We've seen nerve injury following infections like the flu, like COVID for sure. We saw lots of people with neuropathies after COVID. There are a number of genetic conditions that can cause nerve diseases as well. So there are many, many causes for neuropathies. And for patients that start to experience those symptoms, seeing a neurologist and if possible, a neurologist that specializes in peripheral nerves is kind of the first step. And what that neurologist will do then is to say, yes, I think these symptoms are from neuropathy. And then the next question is, well, why? And then hopefully we can figure out a cause. And if we figure out a cause, we're actually pretty good at reversing it. The bad news is we don't figure out the cause very often. So maybe about 25 to 35% of the time do we get that cause. Otherwise, we're just left trying to manage the patient's symptoms.
Got it. So when we talk about diagnosis, you know, and we'll get kind of further into treatment, but when we talk about diagnosis, can you talk about some of the different techniques for diagnosing? Like, how do you diagnose neuropathy?
So there's a few different ways to kind of be pointed in the direction. What I tell patients is when a patient's come to see a neurologist, the first thing that we're taught to think about is the word is called localization. So where in the nervous system is the breakdown occurring? And how is that causing the symptoms? So for example, I could be numb in my hand because I have a pinched nerve in my hand, something simple like carpal tunnel. We don't really think of that as being a neuropathy. That's just a nerve that's pinched somewhere. Or you could have a pinched nerve in the neck causing numbness in the hand. Or you could have a problem in your brain causing numbness in your hand. Or it could be the nerves in your whole body that are affected into more of what we call a neuropathy. So we start really with a physical exam. And so examining the person, looking for certain patterns that we've learned over hundreds of years of studying people that can help us kind of identify, do we think this is a nerve problem or do we think it's a brain problem or a spinal cord problem? That's really the first step. The second step in terms of really confirming that there's a problem with the nerves is a test that if anyone has seen a doctor for this kind of a problem has probably had called a nerve conduction study. And what we do in the nerve conduction study is we apply electrical shocks to the patient's nerves and we see how the nerves carry that electrical signal because nerves all work through electricity. They're like electrical wires. And so we can see, is there a break in that wire? Is the wire not behaving the way that it's supposed to? And if that's true, then that's really a kind of gold standard test for diagnosing a peripheral neuropathy. Now, what people realized about 30 to 40 years ago was that there was a large number of people who had symptoms of peripheral neuropathy, but their physical exam looked relatively normal, and the nerve conduction studies looked relatively normal. And so people began to realize that there are very small nerves that are just below the surface of the skin. And those nerves are too small for us to detect by our physical exam or by the nerve conduction studies. And that sort of led people to say, well, what if we could actually just look at those very small nerves? So if you touch your skin, it's the nerves right below the surface of the skin that allow you to perceive that you've been touched. And so by taking a very small piece of skin and a very special technique, you could actually then look at those nerves and you could determine if the nerves are healthy or sick. So in some cases, the physical exam is normal, the nerve conduction studies are normal, and then we use the skin biopsy to say, oh no, but I can actually see those nerves and I can see that those nerves are sick in some way. And those are basically the three ways that we use to diagnose neuropathy.
And before we dive deeper into the small fibers, can you talk a little bit about the large fibers? Like, what do we learn from a positive nerve conduction or like some of the testing you might do in a physical exam, like either vibration or dull and sharp pain sensation or movement?
Yeah, so there are different sizes of nerves, and each size of the nerve actually conveys a different type of information. So our biggest nerves, the largest nerves, those are the nerves that actually control our balance. So if you think when you walk, you have to very quickly know where one foot is to know where to put the next foot. Uh-huh. And so those nerves have to work very, very quickly. So those are very big nerves that conduct electricity very quickly. When we test a person, we can actually have obviously watch them walk and get a sense of, is their balance correct or not? But we can also test those large nerves by using the tuning fork, by looking at vibration. So that perception of a vibration sense or movement on a tuning fork is sort of a way to test those large fibers. The medium fibers control our strength. So part of that physical exam is testing a person's strength to say, does it look like the motor nerve fibers or the medium fibers are involved as well? And that can help us detect that. The nerve conduction test that tests with the electrical shocks is very good at detecting medium and large nerve fiber injury. So it can tell us in some cases even why those nerves are injured. But in most cases, it's really just telling us that the medium or the large nerve fibers are damaged in some way. The small nerve fibers conduct electricity very slowly. Now, very slowly in the nervous system turns out to be very fast. And so my analogy there is if you're going to reach into your oven to pull out a pan and you accidentally touch the side of the oven, right? Those small nerve fibers are sensing that heat and they're making you pull your hand away very quickly. So that whole circuit of sensing the heat, you know, really pulling your hand away before you even know that it feels hot, right? You sort of sense it a little bit afterwards. That's the slowest our nervous system works. Wow. Wow. And even that obviously is very, very quickly. Yeah. But those small nerve fibers are too small to detect by any test other than actually directly visualizing them.
Got it. Okay, got it. Okay, so when we go in and see a provider in an office who does a neuro exam on us, they're really only able to kind of check the medium and the large fibers, maybe a little bit with sensation, but...
Yeah, so we can get some sense that you alluded to it with kind of touching somebody with a pinprick. Mm-hmm. So that sort of pain is transmitted on the small nerve fibers. So we can get a sense of, do they feel the pinprick the way a pinprick should be felt? Does it feel sharp and a little bit painful? So we'll often do that to people to test those small nerve fibers. But that's a very subjective response from the patient. It's not very objective. And there are many reasons why they could be not perceiving the pinprick as well as they should. So then we need something kind of objective to help confirm that.
I remember at one point learning about nerve distribution and how, you know, on different parts of the body, you can tell different distance of pinprick, like, you know, like the tongue or the fingers are very, you know, very close together. You can tell a very minute change where I think it's, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that like in the middle of the back, it's kind of like things, what feels next to each other is actually the most spacious.
Yeah, so that we call that 2-point discrimination. So that's exactly right. So you can actually touch somebody with like two edges of a paperclip. Uh-huh. And depending on how close together, they can sense that there's still two as opposed to one. Yes. Also allows you to kind of perceive that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Nervous system's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So now we have, you know, we've come into the doctor, we have some kind of problem. They have said, this is not your neuropathy or your symptoms are not medium or large fiber. So then what do we do?
So then the question is, do we want to confirm whether or not there's damage to those small nerve fibers? Mm-hmm. If there's damage to those small nerve fibers, you would then go down the path of trying to figure out, well, what do we think might be causing that damage? So in my practice, I think it's very helpful to confirm that there is something wrong with the small nerve fibers, because again, there are many things that can look and feel the same to the patient. They could be mm-hmm. numb for many different reasons. So you want to know why the person's having that. And as we said before, the best way to do that, really the kind of the gold standard in 2024, is to take a little piece of skin and then to actually stain the nerves so that we can look at those nerves under the microscope. And what we're really doing is we're counting the number of nerves. So we know that for a person's gender, for their age, and for where on their body, because all those factors affect the number of nerves that you're supposed to have, there's a normal number of nerves. And if a person falls below that number of nerves, then they have something that's damaging their nerves, and therefore they have a small fiber neuropathy.
And so talk to us a little bit about that small fiber neuropathy. We're looking at the number of nerves. When you do a skin biopsy, let's kind of go back and do that umbrella about the skin biopsy.
Yep.
Like in our clinic, we will check three sites, but I'm curious your recommendations about can you talk a little bit about what those sites, why those sites, et cetera?
Yeah, so we typically will take three pieces of skin. And the reason for that is that we're also asking, so the first question we're asking is there neuropathy? So mm-hmm. if you take three samples of skin, if there's a neuropathy, you have a little better chance of seeing it in one of those samples. But the second question we're asking is, what is the pattern of the neuropathy? And neuropathies kind of break into two discrete patterns. And we call them length-dependent or non-length-dependent. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a length-dependent neuropathy, what we mean is the longest nerves get affected first. Mm-hmm. And the longest nerves that we have are the nerves that start in your spine, in your lower spine, and go all the way to your big toe. So that's a single cell. If you think about cells, everyone thinks of cells as being microscopic in every direction. Mm-hmm. Nerves are microscopically thin, but they're incredibly long. And so that cell in a tall person could be 2.5 to 3 feet long.
It's amazing.
It's very complicated to keep a 2.5 to 3 foot cell alive for 60, 70, 80, 90 years. And so if anything happens to damage the person's body or damage their nerves, the nerves that are the most likely to be affected first are the longest. And therefore,
So like if that nerve is in the foot, that's like walking you right to the bar where you're going to drink a lot of alcohol every day for 30 years, that long cell might have some particular damage.
It might not be too happy. Correct. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. So that's what we call a length dependent process. And one of the most famous books about neuropathy is called Numb Toes, Burning Feet, for that mm-hmm. reason, which is that most neuropathies are length dependent and they start in the feet. Now, there are some neuropathies that are what we call non-length dependent. And that means they don't affect the longest nerves first. They actually affect the shortest nerves first. Mm-hmm. And that suggests a whole different potential number of causes for their neuropathy. So when we do the three biopsies, we like to take one from very close to the spinal cord, one a little bit further, and then one very far from the spinal cord. And therefore, we can look at that pattern of the nerve loss, and we can say, yes, there's a neuropathy or not. And we can say it's a length-dependent or a non-length-dependent process. And that informs the clinician who's seeing that patient to say, okay, now I want to go down the path of looking for these diseases or these diseases.
And how big a piece of skin are you taking?
So it's 3 millimeters across, which is about a quarter the size of a pencil eraser. So it's very small. It does require a little bit of lidocaine to numb the person up because then we take a little circular blade and we just create a little hole and we pull the piece of skin right out. Doesn't require any stitches. It just heals up like a scab. Within mm-hmm. a few weeks, it looks maybe a little discolored, but otherwise looks normal. Yeah.
Great. Yep. So we just put Band-Aids over them. They're just
exactly.
Yep. Small.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And so we're doing like one on the thigh, one just below the knee,
yep.
lateral on the leg, and then one on the foot. Is that right?
The foot or the ankle, typically. Yeah.
Or ankle.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And so let's talk about small fiber neuropathy. So let's say you see a positive here. What is that? Then what do you do?
So then we would typically do a bunch of blood tests to try to get a sense of what might be wrong with the person. So again, do they have diabetes or early diabetes? Mm-hmm. These days, there's a whole concept that's a kind of emerged that I think is not really talked about enough, which is called metabolic syndrome. And we know that diabetes causes neuropathy, But we know the single biggest risk factor to develop diabetes is to have metabolic syndrome. And what metabolic syndrome implies is you have high blood pressure, you have bad cholesterol, and you're obese. That, unfortunately, is about 30 to 40% of the US population. And that metabolic profile, what's happening in that person's body when those things develop, is damaging the nerves and increasing the risk that they develop diabetes. Mm-hmm. So we look for diabetes, prediabetes, and metabolic syndrome. We look for vitamin and some hormone deficiencies that could cause the problem. We, as you said, we take a good history. So do they drink too much alcohol? That can certainly cause neuropathy. Is there a family history? So is there a chance that this might be a genetic condition? So someone says, oh, my dad had, you know, the same kind of problem with his feet and my grandmother had the problem with her feet. Then that might tell you that you want to do some genetic testing to see if we can identify the cause that way. So typically that's kind of the next step, which is to look for that cause. As I said, unfortunately, a third to a half of the time, even with all the tests that we can order, we don't get a specific cause. My theory, having done this now for almost 30 years, is that we're very good at identifying a single cause and effect. So mm-hmm. person has diabetes, they get neuropathy. We can draw that line and connect those two issues very easily. But what about a person who had a viral infection and then had a little bit of weight loss because of some surgery and then years later developed some other kind of infection? And so there may be many people where it's an accumulation of small insults where none of them was big enough to say, oh, this is definitely the problem. But again, because you're trying to keep that cell alive for an entire lifetime and that cell is so long, I think the accumulation of little insults over time probably is what's leading to a lot of these neuropathies where we can't identify a single cause.
It's so interesting that you talk about that because that's exactly kind of our like progress thinking about in the toxicology world, right?
Yes.
So we know that if you are at the arsenic plant and there's an explosion and you've had some big exposure, we can point to it and say, ooh, that's bad, and we can measure it. But really our exposure to arsenic in playground equipment or in rice or our cadmium exposure or our lead exposure, even though it's been outlawed from paint since in gasoline since the 70s, we know that a lot of those persistent organic chemicals are now continue to pervade our system. So there was just a paper that came out in 2021, I think, about microplastics in the air over Yellowstone, the idea being that even in these remote areas, we're still being, we're still inhaling plastic into our lungs, which obviously it doesn't belong there. You're putting gravel in the gas tank. So, a lot of these, and it's really hard to figure out how to measure that accumulation of insults over time.
Yeah, I give exactly the same example, which is if it's a single high dose poisoning, we can identify that easily. Yeah. The good news is that doesn't happen very often anymore. Yeah. So that's good. But that kind of chronic low-level stuff, and it may be that some people, because of their own genetic factors, are more predisposed to that. So you and I may be exposed to the same amount of arsenic or cadmium. And for me, it's not a problem, but for you, it could be a problem. And we're just not smart enough to know how to measure that or how to assess that. But to me, I think that definitely could be one of the many factors that leads to this over time.
And I would also, I'd love to chat about kind of the autoimmune piece because, Washington University in St. Louis has a great autonomic lab. They've got some really interesting autoimmune antibodies that they test. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about some of these more esoteric antibodies in terms of like, why don't we test them everywhere? Because then we know how to treat some autoimmune diseases. But if we look for just an ANA, an anti-nuclear antibody, and that's normal, and we say, well, you don't have any autoimmune disease, we might be missing a lot of patients.
Yeah. So it's another one of those interesting areas where if a person has a systemic autoimmune disease, so for example, they have lupus or they have Sjogren's, then we're really pretty good at figuring that out, that they have that systemic autoimmune disease. What we're not so good at figuring out is, well, what if that autoimmune disease is just confined to their nerves? And how do we identify those people? Now, I trained at WashU, so I know Dr. Pestrunk, who runs that lab, very well. And he's made a career out of identifying these, what we call autoantibodies. So antibodies that are targeting a person's own body. And in some cases, those are very specific. So if you find a specific antibody, there's one, for example, called GM1 that damages only motor nerves. Very rare for a healthy person to have that antibody. Most people that have that antibody have a motor nerve disease that's caused by that antibody. So some are very specific. Some are less specific. So I published a paper 2 years ago where Dr. Pestrunk had identified a couple of new antibodies that seem to be very tied to the small fiber neuropathy world. And so we asked the question, well, if you have a patient that has small fiber neuropathy and has these antibodies, and then you treat them for an autoimmune disease, do they get better? Mm-hmm. Now, our study was small, but they didn't get better. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be because we chose the wrong treatment, or mm-hmm. it could be because those antibodies are not that specific. And I tend to think about it as kind of like a bullseye approach, mm-hmm. which is if you just rely on an antibody, mm-hmm. you're probably going to be wrong as much as you are right.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have that antibody, and let's say the person's symptoms began very suddenly, and mm-hmm. let's say it's a non-length dependent pattern, mm-hmm. and they have other markers of an autoimmune disease. So the more pieces you can kind of put together to build the story about an autoimmune neuropathy, the more likely you are to be right. But mm-hmm. you may also miss some people that don't have that whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of what we call the sensitivity and the specificity of a test. Mm-hmm. And these have not really been worked out very well yet, but we do, in certain circumstances, look for these antibodies in people. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so fascinating. I'm curious if you have names for the ones that he was looking at through that paper.
So the ones that we did in the paper, one was called FGFR3 mm-hmm. and one was called TSHDS.
Those two specifically, I have seen come up a few times in long COVID yeah. patients specifically.
Yeah. So very interesting, again, after viral infections. So we know, for example, we've known for as long as we've had vaccines that about 1 in 1 million people that get a vaccine can develop a very severe nerve disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Mm-hmm. That is probably because the vaccine is stimulating their immune system. Their immune mm-hmm. system goes a little bit goofy because it's kind of revved up as a result of that vaccine and now mm-hmm. decides to start attacking their nerves. Mm-hmm. So we know that that happens after vaccines. We also know that it happens after viral infections for the same reason, that the person's immune system gets revved up trying to fight that virus and mm-hmm. a little bit of the immune system goes the wrong way and does something it's not supposed to do. And those are not really unique to nerve. So we see that affecting, you know, a person's immune system starts to attack their heart or their kidney or their liver after mm-hmm. viral infections. So it's very likely that those things are connected. And again, that kind of a story of a person who had a viral infection like COVID or got the COVID vaccine, then developed a neuropathy, now has these antibodies, that's starting in my mind to make a pretty good story mm-hmm. that they're all relevant. Mm-hmm. But a person who has none of that and just happens to have one of those antibodies, maybe it's not as relevant and we just don't know yet. Yeah.
And it's so much exactly as you were saying, that accumulation of small insults. I feel like that could be a whole book about yeah. how like how health goes sideways because mm-hmm. it is really, you know, all it's the burden, you know, minus the ability to manage the burden that equals essentially the yep. presentation of disease process. And everybody's got different weights and different categories about how well they do their elimination and their cellular clearance, you know, whether you have constipation and you're not pooping or whether you have, you know, mm-hmm. how everything is moving versus how well you're sweating mm-hmm. versus how much burden you're taking in, all of those things.
So. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely correct. That's right. And so all you really get to do, unfortunately, because we're just not smart enough yet, is yeah. you try to stack the odds in your favor, right?
Right. Yeah. So, may the odds ever be in your favor. This is a yeah. Hunger Games kind of situation.
Right, exactly. I mean, patients ask me all the time, like, what can they do? And I'm like, I don't really know exactly what you're supposed to do, but probably the healthier you are, the better things will be. Right?
Yes, yes.
Which sounds very trite and stupid, but it's probably true, you know.
So. It's very much, you know, as we're having this conversation, my background, my first medical training was actually in Ayurvedic medicine, the traditional medicine of India. And I got so interested in that, that I kind of dove into all of this Western medicine, you know, starting a long time ago now, starting over 20 years ago. But but Ayurveda has a whole description of what digestion means and what digestion is and how things are supposed to move along the pathway and how the body is supposed to be astute at plucking out the correct things, and about how when digestion doesn't go well, it creates something called amba, which is basically like it's described as like a morbid, toxic, sticky substance, and that it coats cells and it interrupts cellular communication, and that's how poor digestion can directly lead to autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. Because when the cells can't communicate well, they can't listen to each other. And so then the cells start, if they're not responding well, then they say, oh, something's wrong with this cell over here. We got to destroy it. And let's make an antibody to take care of it. So
yeah, there's a lot of amazing science now with the gut. So you probably know in Parkinson's disease that if you have idiopathic constipation after the age of 50, that you're 4 times more likely to develop Parkinson's disease over the next 20 years. Now, some people think that's because the nerves are already getting damaged and so the gut's slowing down, but it may be that with the gut slowing down, it's perpetuating something and speeding up the aging process in some way. So yeah, it's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about that also, because we, you know, when you're talking about these small fibers, it's easy to think of like a motor fiber or a sensory fiber. But can you talk a little bit more about these autonomic fibers and kind of what drives them and how do they act and like where are they throughout? Like you kind of gave us a list, but let's go through that again, because I think it's important for listeners to remember that part.
So there's autonomic nerves really everywhere throughout our body. The one nerve that people, you know, I think often have heard of is the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is one of the big central kind of autonomic nerves that runs up through the neck up to the brain. And the autonomic nerves control a lot of different functions. So the main ones are controls the heart rate, and it controls the blood pressure. It controls our temperature regulation, controls our sweating, controls things like goosebumps that you get if you're cold or, you know, have an emotional response to something. And it also controls digestion, so the way that the gut moves, and also controls the bladder function. So again, all things that you can't really think about doing that happen automatically. So the nerves are really scattered widely throughout our body and do come down from the brain. Those nerves end again in the surface of the skin. So there are these very tight connections between the way that the brain works and what's happening in the skin. Now, one of the things that's interesting is if you go back to when we were a single cell, kind of embryologically, and then we start to divide to become a few cells, the cells of the brain and the cells of the skin started as the same cell. They started as what's called the ectoderm. And so maybe that's why there's this close connection. But a few examples I think that sort of bring the point home is if you hear a beautiful piece of music, right? You might get goosebumps. Mm-hmm. So that's your brain changing something about your skin. If you get embarrassed, you flush, you turn red. Mm-hmm. If you're in pain, you might turn pale. Mm-hmm. So the skin has a lot of these very tight, almost immediate connections to what's happening inside the brain. And so we have my new lab, what we've done over the last 10 years or so, has really tried to study those nerves in the skin as a way of understanding the connections and what's happening inside the brain. So it's a whole lot harder to get a piece of brain than it is to get a piece
of skin. Nobody likes that.
Nobody likes that. No. Yeah. But it turns out that you can learn a lot about what's happening in the brain, particularly in diseases like Parkinson's disease, by studying those autonomic nerves in the skin.
Fantastic. So the skin biopsy, so that your company, CND Life Sciences, doesn't only check in this, you know, we talk about it being a skin biopsy, but we're not only checking for small fiber neuropathy. Tell us what else can be tested in that test.
Yeah, so we really created C&D Life Sciences to allow us to kind of use the peripheral nerves, the nerves of the autonomic nervous system, as a way of studying what's happening in the central nervous system. And where we began doing that and where we focused for the last 10 years is in a group of diseases that are the most common is Parkinson's disease. But these diseases we've known for about 100 years occur because proteins build up inside the nerves of the brain. And one of the proteins that does that is a protein called synuclein. And so synuclein also affects the autonomic nerves. So what we realized is that you could study the nerves in the skin. You could look for this protein called synuclein. And if you saw that the synuclein was accumulating, then that was a very strong indication that the protein was also accumulating in the brain. And therefore, the person's symptoms could be due to Parkinson's disease or dementia with Lewy bodies or a couple of other more rare conditions. But
Like
that's
multiple
really
system
been, sorry?
atrophy.
Yes, multiple system atrophy and one called pure autonomic failure. So we're really the first people to be able to use the peripheral nervous system as a window into the central nervous system.
And the synuclein, synuclein is a protein that we expect that the brain normally makes, and now we see it as misfolded or is in too high a quantity. What are we finding if we find it abnormal in the skin?
Yeah, so the theory, again, nobody knows for sure. There's a lot of unknowns in most of neurology. So one of the first unknowns is that everybody has this protein called synuclein. Every nerve in our body contains that protein. And that protein is basically essential for our nerves to function, but we don't really know what it does yet. We just know that if you don't have it or if it's in an abnormal form, it's going to cause problems. What we also know is that in its normal form, it dissolves in liquid. So our body is mostly water. And therefore, our proteins just kind of float around in liquid, kind of like, you know, salt in a water solution, right? But if that protein starts to misfold, then it'll start to accumulate, and now it can't dissolve in the liquid anymore. And if it can't dissolve, then it's going to start to build up and build up. And the belief is at some point, that protein builds up so much that it then damages that nerve and that nerve dies. Now, there is another theory that says, this probably would appeal to your Ayurvedic medicine approach to life, which is it's not just that the bad protein builds up, it's also that the good protein goes down. And so again, it's the balance of the two. And I tend to think that makes a little more sense to me than just the toxic form. So one theory says you've got the bad form building up. As the bad form builds up, your good form goes down. And we know that if you don't have enough of the good form of the protein, the nerve won't be able to function. So it's one of those two, either too much bad or not enough good. But that protein builds up into something called a Lewy body. And Lewy body was named after the pathologist who first discovered it about 100 years ago in the brains of people with Parkinson's disease. And each of these diseases, Parkinson's disease, dementia with Lewy bodies, has these Lewy body pathology in the brain. And we can see basically the equivalent of that pathology in the nerves in the skin now.
Sometimes I tell patients it's like if you're working at the Gap and you're trying to, you know, when it's quiet on the floor, you can fold all the sweaters all nice and everything's lined up and you can see what colors are where. But then if it's a chaotic day and everybody's like, you know, Black Friday, then it's like you're trying to hurriedly fold everything and nothing is straight and nothing is right and nobody can find anything and it's a big mess.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I like that.
Like
I may
just
use that.
abnormal protein deposition. That's how I describe it.
And there are many other diseases like that. So the most common disease where we think the protein misfolding is a problem is Alzheimer's disease. So in Alzheimer's disease, proteins around the nerves misfold and proteins inside the nerves misfold. They're different proteins than the protein in Parkinson's disease. So in Alzheimer's disease, it's tau and amyloid. In Parkinson's disease, it's synuclein, but it's the same kind of pathology that we see when we look at people's brains at autopsy. We see this accumulation of protein that shouldn't be there.
again, the thing we don't want to do while we're living is try to take a piece out of the brain to look at
yes.
it.
Yes.
So in the CND Life Sciences skin biopsy, we're counting the small fibers.
Yes.
And then we're also looking for amyloid and synuclein. Yes.
Correct.
And then if we find synuclein, does that give a diagnosis of like what, how correlated can be this final diagnosis?
It's a great statistical question. So here's the way to think about it is that if you have symptoms that look like it could be Parkinson's disease, and we find this abnormal protein in the nerves, it makes it very likely that it's Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
But it starts with the person's symptoms. Mm-hmm. So to the point I made earlier, there may be some people that have a little bit of this abnormal protein in their nerves, but maybe they have a lot of the good protein, mm-hmm. and therefore they don't have any symptoms. Mm-hmm. Now, it could be a risk factor that says at some point down the road, 10 years later, 20 years later, they might develop symptoms, mm-hmm. but we don't really know what that means. We don't know if it means 2 years, 20 years, or 200 years. And we don't know what kinds of things a person can do. Gets back to, again, my trite recommendation, which is be healthy. Because the healthier mm-hmm. you are, your body might be able to fight off this bad protein for longer, which is what it's hoping to do. So in a healthy person, in a relatively healthy person, we wouldn't recommend doing the biopsy. But if you did and you found the abnormal protein, it probably is a risk factor, but it doesn't mean that you have the disease. In a person who has the symptoms of the disease and then has the protein, we would then say, well, then it's very likely that that's what the disease is, that it's Parkinson's or dementia with Lewy bodies. But it still starts with the clinical picture.
And the clinical picture for Parkinson's would be gait disturbances, cognitive dysfunction, constipation, that constipation piece or bowel changes.
And they get the rest tremor. So it's a very characteristic rest tremor. And then slowness. So kind of the three cardinal features are what we call bradykinesia, which means their movements just become slower. They often don't blink as much as other people blink. They don't move their facial muscles the way people do. They just look a little flatter, and it's just because their movements are slower. They have the rest tremor, which means that when they're doing something with their hand, it's not that bad. But when they're just sitting at rest, the tremor will start. And it's often described as a pill rolling tremor, like you're rolling a pill between your thumb and your first finger. And then the gait problems. So they develop postural instability, which means they're just not as stable on their feet as they should be.
Is part of that from neuropathy itself?
So about 80% of people with Parkinson's do have a bit of neuropathy, but the gait instability in people with Parkinson's is really more of a brain problem than it is a nerve problem. Yeah.
I remember learning, one way to like, so our feet give us so much information about where we are in space.
Yep.
And so if you want to check one check for, to kind of look at people's balance and gait neuropathy is just have them stand still, do a Romberg, have them stand still with and close their eyes.
Yeah.
Their eyes aren't there to, if you're really able to isolate their balance on their feet and they have problems, that gives good information about what they can sense, what they can perceive.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great test for peripheral neuropathy. In Parkinson's, one of the most sensitive tests actually is to get them with their feet apart and you just tug on their shoulders a little bit. You give them a little bit of backwards pressure. And for most of us, we can compensate for that very easily. But in Parkinson's, they may then have to step backwards a number of steps to kind of gain their balance back. So any little bit that throws them off, they have a tough time to compensate for.
And Parkinson's does not have great, like it really is still a clinical diagnosis unless you're doing a DAT scan, right?
Yeah. So basically there's a few different tests now to kind of help with the diagnosis. So one is the test that we do, we call the SYN1 test. So trying to identify that abnormal protein. The second would be a DAT scan. The DAT scan is not that specific. It just sort of tells you that part of the brain that's damaged in Parkinson's is damaged. Mm-hmm. But you have to lose about 60% of those nerves before the DAT scan becomes abnormal. So early on, it's not a very sensitive test. And then there's another test called a seeding assay, where they can look using spinal fluid to look for abnormalities as well. So we have a few tests that kind of now help with the diagnosis. And then again, there are some genetic tests that can help as well.
Right. And so then the amyloid, let's talk a little bit about the amyloid component. Like how much does that correlate and how do you use that with the patient picture?
Yeah, so the amyloid, there's two types of amyloid. Again, many people, when we say amyloid, they think about Alzheimer's disease, and that's something called beta amyloid. So we cannot yet look for that in the skin. We're actually actively researching that and hope to be able to do that at some point. So this is a different type of amyloid that occurs in people that develop neuropathies, and particularly neuropathies that affect the autonomic nervous system. So because we're looking at the autonomic nerves, if we see that there's damage, again, the question becomes, well, why is there damage? And it's not a very common disease, but amyloid can cause that. And what's important about that is that untreated, it's actually fatal. And we now have very effective treatments to prevent that from happening. So we look for the amyloid neuropathy in patients with the idea that if we find it, we could actually prevent their worsening by treating the underlying disease.
And if you are like a listener, if you're not Dr. Todd Levine listening to this, having been a neurologist for 20 years, like what kind of clinical picture would you be thinking about if you would need this test, like for the amyloid? What would your presenting clinical picture look like?
It's usually symptoms that relate to the autonomic nervous system. So it could be that your blood pressure drops very easily. So people often pass out that have autonomic neuropathies, particularly if you change position. So if you think about most of us, if you stand up too fast one day, maybe you didn't hydrate enough, you get a little lightheaded. That's because the amount of blood in your brain is a little bit low and your body is telling you, whoa, hold on a second, right? Give me a minute just to get together, right? If you have autonomic neuropathies, when you stand up, you may not be able to get yourself together. And there may be a long enough period of time where your brain doesn't get enough blood that you actually pass out. So patients that are passing out for no good reason, meaning it's not a heart disease or any other issue, that can be a problem. Patients with severe constipation, gastroparesis, where the stomach doesn't work, those can be symptoms of amyloid. Just regular neuropathies. So some of these patients will start with small fiber neuropathies or large fiber neuropathies, and that can be caused by amyloid as well. So those are probably the more common symptoms. Again, it's a rare condition, but if you do have those symptoms, it gets you to, again, the localization to say something's wrong with the autonomic nervous system, and then you want to look for why. And so our ability to look for that amyloid is at least one potential why.
And if you do find that amyloid, is it like, you know, can you be a healthy person with some of that amyloid in your skin? Is that going to either be potentially, like you were saying, a risk factor for healthy people or potentially predictive of things to watch as you age over the next decades?
In most people, if the amyloid has begun to accumulate, then you have to treat that because that will get worse with time. Again, the good news is we've got two very effective therapies for that. They're not cheap or simple. But they do work and they do prevent the accumulation. But the amyloid can accumulate in the heart and eventually cause the heart to stop working. It can accumulate in the kidneys and cause the kidneys to stop working. So it is a disease that you have to kind of treat aggressively if you find it. Right now with synuclein, we don't have that kind of a therapy. It would be wonderful if we did, because then we'd say if we identify synuclein, we could put people on these therapies and prevent them from getting worse or prevent them maybe from ever getting Parkinson's or dementia in the first place. There's about 30 different molecules that are being developed by pharmaceutical companies right now, all trying to do that. So it is a huge area of interest. I just came back from a week in Lisbon where that's all the people are talking about is, you know, hoping that a few of these drugs can actually become effective. But right now we do have it for amyloid, but we don't have it for synuclein.
And what are the names of the amyloid drugs?
The one that most people use is called tafamidis. Yes, they block the accumulation of the protein.
Great, great. So interesting. And again, you know, as we've just to reiterate our theme of, you know, accumulation of many small insults, and the idea of being healthy, just be healthy. That's a lot of what Ayurveda was based on in terms of like, for the accumulation of many small insults, you want to also accumulate the impact of many small healthy aspects of living, so that
yes.
when you like work with an Ayurvedic practitioner, the idea is personalized medicine. That's what they did, you know, 5 to 10,000 years ago. But looking at what is the right diet for you, what is the right sleep pattern for you, what is the right exercise pattern, what is the right meditation, what is the right breath work, what is the right everything. So get real granular with it. Very interesting. So let's say that you either, you know, you engage in a treatment, either the, you know, treatment for amyloid or the treatment for, say, Parkinson's or the many small treatments of integrative medicine. How likely are you to see, or let's say for an autoimmune autonomic neuropathy, if you're doing something like IVIG or even plasmapheresis, like for something like Guillain-Barré, how likely are you to see these results change after treatment?
So for the autoimmune diseases, we're really pretty good at treating people. So most people will get better. And that better can either be getting stronger or less pain or regrowing new nerves. So we see all of that occurring in those kinds of conditions. So that's sort of the good news there. For the other conditions right now, as you said, you know, if you're focusing just on wellness or Ayurvedic medicine, I think we don't really know. What we do know is that as the disease progresses, so say take Parkinson's, for example, as Parkinson's gets worse, we see more of this protein accumulating in the nerves. Mm-hmm. So what we're involved in some studies now, and what we'd love to be able to show is, if you had that and you did certain lifestyle modifications, could that actually slow the progression of the protein accumulation? So we don't know that yet. We're starting to do some projects to at least understand what the natural history is. So then we can see if there's been a change. But it's the kind of thing that changes slowly over time. So we do have some you know, medical providers say, well, should I repeat the biopsy? Don't really know the perfect answer to that, but probably if you were going to do that, it'd be something that you repeated 1 or 2 years later and just sort of say, did that intervention help? So these are not rapid changes and they're not rapid interventions, but you might see over a couple of years that it's either continuing to progress or that it's stopped progressing. And we might be able to see that over a couple year window.
Okay. Kind of like a DEXA scan almost. Like
Yeah.
And we know too that with antibody activity, a person can have an antibody and not have the clinical presentation, or, you know, there is sometimes where the person has a clinical presentation and we can't find the antibody.
Yep.
A lot of antibody hubris, I think, in medicine. Yep. Like there's so many that still probably out there to be found.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm curious, just before we wrap up here, what kind of research are, like, what should we see coming down the pike? What are you excited about? Yeah. What are you curious about?
So probably the area that we're most interested in at the moment is how early can we find these changes?
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, if you figure a person who develops Parkinson's, by the time they get to all the symptoms of the Parkinson's, they've probably lost about 50% of the nerves in their brain. And it's unlikely that we're going to regrow those back in my lifetime. So where we're going to be more effective is identifying the person early and then getting them onto some kind of treatment, whatever that is, and then preventing the development of the disease in the first place. So one of the earliest conditions that we know of that is a risk factor for Parkinson's is a disease called REM behavior disorder. And so in REM behavior disorder, what happens is when we sleep, we go through 4 stages of sleep, and then we go into REM sleep. And in REM sleep is where we dream. So when we dream, our brain induces something called sleep paralysis, which means that you don't act out your dreams. People with REM behavior disorder, when they dream, their brains don't do that. And so they do act out their dreams. And about 80% of the people that develop REM behavior disorder will go on to develop Parkinson's or dementia with Lewy bodies. So we're now doing a big NIH-sponsored study to look at those people to say, can we identify the protein in them? And then if you could, that would be the person that you'd really want to treat with a disease-modifying therapy, because then you could actually prevent dementia with Lewy bodies or prevent Parkinson's disease. So that kind of earlier, what we call prodromal illnesses, we think is a really big area of interest for us. And we've got some NIH-sponsored grants that are helping us study that now. So that's probably, from within our lab, our biggest area of interest. And then the second is that many pharmaceutical companies are developing these drugs now. And we now have the ability to quantify the amount of that protein in the skin. So again, we think in a shorter period of time, we might be able to tell the pharmaceutical company, hey, this is, you're onto something here, or you're not onto something here. Because right now they don't have any way to measure the protein. So they're trying to lower the level of the protein with no way to measure it, which is obviously very difficult to do. So we're now working with 7 different pharmaceutical companies, probably a few more this year, on their drug trials to see if we can actually show them that their medication is working.
Oh, fascinating. Fascinating. Amazing. So this is, we are here with you today with Dr. Todd Levine, and this was all about skin biopsies. We do offer this at our clinic, Nervata Health in Seattle. But there are obviously locations all over the country where you can figure out where and how to get a skin biopsy to look for these conditions. Any last thoughts or words?
No, this is really enjoyable. I think it's been a great hour, and hope I'm able to teach everybody something. So
absolutely. So we love that you've joined us today to discuss how to make our whole world medicine. We rise or fall together and are committed to sharing knowledge and insight that empower us and our communities towards greater health. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.